And Henry Davis had, you know, had hurt me previously, but I'd been really holding on to it and hadn't raised it with him. And by holding on to it, I hadn't shown him mercy or the sort of forgiveness that we're talking about, and I slipped out in a heated moment, which then hurt him. And then he was angry with me. Thankfully, we were able to forgive one another, and really beautiful restoration happened. But the point of me sharing this is that everything I'm about to say, well, I really need to hear it as well. Okay, so we'll begin. This parable has some amount of money in it, and I thought it'd be helpful to get a feel for this in more modern terms. So we'll start with the second servant who owed 100 silver coins. I'm told this is about 4 months' salary for a day labourer. In Australia, $23 an hour is the minimum wage for a casual worker. So 4 months of that would be about $16,000. So for any of us, that's a significant amount of money to owe to somebody. On the other hand, the first servant owed 10,000 bags of gold, which is about 600,000 times as much, which makes it almost $10 billion in our money. In 20 years, he could have paid back one bag of gold, and that's only if he didn't spend any money on actually living his life. It would take 200,000 years for a day laborer to earn enough to pay back the 10,000 bags of gold. I think it's probably like Jesus saying he owed his master a gazillion dollars, right? It's not just a large sum of money, it's more money than any normal person could grasp. And so, when he asked his master for patience to repay the debt, he wasn't asking for something the master really could have granted. No matter how long he was given, he'd never be able to repay it. So he begged for a kind of mercy, which is patience, but his master was extravagantly merciful to him. The master completely forgave his debt. So Jesus had just finished telling his disciples how to deal with sin in the church, which is to go to them one-on-one and point out their sin with the hope of winning them over. And I feel like Peter's question at the beginning of our reading was in response to this. Peter's saying, Jesus, that's some hard teaching, but yeah, I'll do it. What about when it's not just some general sin? What about when it's sin against me? Surely there are limits. And I think Peter would have been feeling pretty generous to offer to forgive seven times. As is often the case, I don't think Jesus' response was what Peter was expecting. And he describes two systems. The first system, the master's preferred system, is one of mercy, where unpayable debts are forgiven. And the second is one of justice, where everybody gets what they deserve. And the master says, well, I'm going to offer you mercy. And at first it seems like the servant accepts the father's mercy. At first it seems like he says, yes, thank you. I'll live under this wonderful system of mercy. But then he's confronted with a choice. Will I extend mercy to the other servant who owes me, or will I exercise my legal right to demand payment? And Jesus tells us that by demanding payment, the servant rejected the master's mercy and accepted the only alternative, justice. And he paid the price. Jesus' final words to us bring it home. We are servants with unpayable debts, and God is offering us mercy, but we can choose justice if we really want to. If we want to operate in a system of justice, we can, but if we recognize that we have an unpayable debt, it seems pretty foolish to reject mercy and ask for justice. I used to love this parable because it had such a satisfying ending. How could the first servant not leave his master's court eagerly desiring to share the forgiveness he had received? How could he not thank God for the opportunity to forgive just a small amount compared to what he had been forgiven? When he refused to show mercy on his fellow servant, I was filled with righteous anger. Who doesn't enjoy the moment at the end when the evil, unmerciful servant gets thrown in prison? But imagine the parable without the first half. Imagine if it was just a story about a guy who owed $16,000 and demanded it back. That would be fair, right? When we are unforgiving, we show that we've forgotten how much we've been forgiven. In a sense, we're actually rejecting God's forgiveness of us. We're saying thanks but no thanks to God's offer of mercy, and instead opting for our right to justice. I've certainly said these things to myself. Enough is enough. I've forgiven this brother or sister for so many things. They've used up all my patience, all my mercy. I'm done with them. And Jesus reminds us of who God is and who we are. Jesus tells us that God is a God of mercy and that he is a God of justice. In Exodus 34, God describes himself. He says, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. Tin, can you put up my slide? This is just in case everyone gets totally confused. Those are the four things. So, number two, God calls us to forgive sin. In this parable, we get a powerful picture of the mercy of God and a frightening reminder of his justice. We learn that God will see that mercy triumphs, except in the case of the person who insists that their own personal justice should triumph. We see a God who loves mercy, but will treat us with justice unless we treat others mercifully. So we know that when we truly grasp God's forgiveness of us, we must forgive our brothers and sisters. But what must we forgive, and how are we to go about it? Turn with me. I won't actually turn, but go back to verse 15. And we see Jesus' instructions on how to deal with a brother or sister who sins. I'll read it out. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault, just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. So what do we do when our brother or sister sins? Jesus tells us that we are to go to them privately with the hope of winning them over, of reconciling with them, of restoring the relationship through forgiveness. And this is the teaching of Jesus that caused Peter to ask how many times he must forgive his brother or sister. After hearing this, Peter asked, "Surely, Lord, there must be limits." Why was this teaching so hard? I think it's because we're not talking about minor offenses here. We're not talking about just bearing with one another, about annoyances or inconveniences or anything like that. I think Jesus is talking about serious sin, sin that breaks relationship, sin that maybe really, really hurts. It's important to remember that forgiveness here is not excusing sinful behavior. The behavior will be dealt with, but the outcome we hope for, the outcome we persevere for, is winning our brother or sister back, restoring the relationship. It's not punishing or exacting any sort of justice or revenge. Forgiveness is costly. Sometimes the cost is material, like in this parable, but other times the cost is personal. It's not easy to forgive when someone has hurt you or someone you love, especially when you aren't able to punish them. There's a cost. In these verses, Jesus puts the responsibility on individual disciples. Jesus says that the kingdom of heaven is a merciful community where everyone pursues the sinner. What happens if we can't win our brother or sister back, even after reaching out one-on-one, or even after involving others, or perhaps even the whole church? The final punishment is not excommunication. It's treating the unrepentant sinner as you would a pagan or a tax collector. And I don't think it should escape our attention that this account was probably written by the same tax collector Jesus reached out to and called to follow him back in chapter 9. So, yeah, the first thing we learn from this parable is that we are to be merciful, that to the degree that we grasp God's forgiveness of us, we'll be forgiving of others. I think the second thing that we learn is the responsibility it lies with each of us as individual disciples to pursue this reconciliation. In our churches, it's easy for the ordinary disciple to hide behind the leaders, appealing to Cain's question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" This passage asserts that the answer is yes. When I read the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis, I'm grieved by how little Cain loved his brother Abel, by how little was needed to get him to murder his brother. And his question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" reveals his heart, reveals his deep lack of love for his brother. Elsewhere in Matthew, Jesus tells us that if we're angry with our brother without cause, we deserve the same punishment that comes from murdering them. What do we do instead of pursuing restoring and forgiving our brothers and sisters? We tend to sulk, keep it to ourselves. Or maybe we tell others, "Just to get it out of my system, I'm just venting, guys." What Jesus tells us is that that's not okay. We need to go to the person who's offended us and try to restore the relationship. It's important to take on this responsibility ourselves. We can't leave it to someone else to deal with. So I don't want to downplay that because I think it's something we really do. But as with everything, we're in danger of taking this teaching too far. So I see two additional areas of potential sin, and that's gossip and being too eager to rebuke. So While preparing for this, I read something that I think helps us avoid these sins. And it's to think about why God allows us to see someone else's sin. If God allows you to know something about a brother or sister that does not reflect well upon them, he does that for three reasons. One, so you can pray for them. Two, so that you can lovingly go and point it out to them. And three, so that you can avoid the same sin. For those of us who are eager to rebuke or maybe prone to gossip, it's important to remember that when we confront a brother or sister about their sin, it needs to be the humble approach of one child to another. All right, so number three. God calls us to pursue one another. We've seen that because we're forgiven, we must be eager to forgive others, and that we must pursue our brothers and sisters, hoping for reconciliation. And Jesus gives us a wonderful picture of the Father's heart for all believers a few verses earlier, starting in verse 10, which I'll read. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. What do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wandered off? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he's happier about the one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should perish. In this parable, we see the Father's heart for his people. And we see Jesus inviting us to share in his work as the Good Shepherd. I struggle a lot with everything I've been talking about. I'm frequently the opposite of the God that I claim to follow. I'm ungracious, I'm quick to anger, abounding in indifference and faithlessness. I'm often happy to accept God's grace for myself, but go around punishing others. I'm terrified of confronting sin in others, of admitting that I've been hurt. I'd much prefer to write someone off, to stop bothering with them, and to seek to win them back through a loving, personal, humble conversation about what I've seen and felt. Let me tell you, I think pursuing people in this way, pursuing wandering sheep with the sort of limitless forgiveness, is one of the most powerful ways we can live out our love for one another. Jesus says that the world will know we're his disciples by the love we have for one another, and it's this sort of love, love that perseveres, that hopes, that doesn't count wrongs. It's this sort of love that the world isn't used to. Even sinners love those who love them, right? We're called to love those who don't love us. It seems so rare for people to actually deal with broken relationships, to seek healing. I've heard many stories of friendships breaking down, of relationship breakdown, where one party said, "I had no idea things were so bad. If only they'd said something sooner." Jesus is calling us to be a people who live in the mercy of the Father, who don't let things get to the point where relationships become broken. I haven't actually experienced a lot of this sort of love in my life. I seem to be a person with a great capacity to wound others. And there haven't been many times in my life where someone's turned around and said, "I love you too much to let you destroy our relationship." A few months ago, a brother from Barney's did this for me. He said with tears in his eyes, "Jason, you've got to be more careful with what you say. It really hurts." And that was hard for me to hear, but I've never felt so deeply loved. And it gave me a security in our relationship that I treasure. Now I could see that, yes, sometimes I would do some pretty horrible things, things that cannot be ignored, things that do not deserve but need forgiveness. But in the midst of all this, our relationship wouldn't be irreparably damaged. He wouldn't throw me in the bin when he's hurt by my sin and brokenness. Jesus doesn't just love his church, he loves you. He loves the wanderer, the one out of fellowship. He loves the one who hurt others by his or her lack of diplomacy. He loves that one who has offended you. Jesus is concerned for them, so do not write them off. Do not ignore them. Never give up on people. Go to them and seek to win them back. Persevere with them because Christ hung in there for us. Each one of us is precious to him. We are a community of forgiven sinners, and that means we forgive one another and we pursue one another. In love, not seven times, but 77 times. Jesus tells us that it is impossible to claim forgiveness by God and continue bearing grudges against our brothers and sisters. Finally, we'll return to the beginning, to the parable of the unmerciful servant. Though we may hate to admit it, everyone in this room is like that first servant at some point in his journey. If you've not received God's forgiveness, you're the servant at verse 23. The Bible tells us that we're all sinners, even if we don't acknowledge it. And in the language of this story, you owe the master a debt you could never hope to repay. If this is you, the good news is that God longs to forgive your debt. His first preference is to show you mercy. In Isaiah 53, it says this: "Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed." And that's, of course, talking about Jesus. God so longs to show you mercy that he sent his son to die an unimaginably horrible death to secure that mercy for us. If you have trusted in Jesus and received God's forgiveness, you're the servant of verse 27. You went to God with no legitimate defense and threw yourself on his mercy. And he responded with more than you asked for. His response was more wonderful than you could have hoped. You came under God's regime of mercy. And through Jesus' death and resurrection, God no longer counts your debt against you. God himself has absorbed the cost of your debt. There is more to the story, of course. And though we are all at either verse 23 or 27, all either sinners or forgiven sinners, the Christian life is not about just having your sin forgiven. It's not about avoiding, or it's not simply about avoiding the debtor's prison, but about living under God's system of unfathomably rich mercy. We talk about what we've been saved from. We've been saved from sin, and what we've been saved into. We've been saved into a system of mercy. And yeah, if we're going to choose to live under that system, we need to be merciful. This parable talks about a really important aspect of the Christian life, which is showing mercy to our brothers and sisters. I think it's safe to say that those of us who have received God's forgiveness for our unpayable, inexcusable, unimaginable debt have also failed on occasion to forgive others for far more minor infractions. And in failing to forgive others, we have failed in a deep way to receive God's forgiveness. Many of us have moved from verse 23 to verse 27 and barreled right through to verse 30. The basis of God's forgiveness for you is not whether you have forgiven others. He forgives the servant freely right at the beginning of the story, when all he's done is incur the debt and ask for mercy. But the warning from Jesus is clear. The reality of your forgiveness must show itself in your forgiveness of others. This is a hard teaching. Forgiveness is not easy. So what do you do if you're struggling to forgive someone? Willpower alone can't help you forgive someone from your heart. The only way we can extend forgiveness to people who have really hurt us is by grasping more fully the extraordinary forgiveness that we have received. So how do you do that? I think it's through spending time in prayer. Be honest with God about how you feel. Name the hurt that you feel. Have you been wronged? Bring it to God. Ask him to show you the way that he responds to your hurting of him. Are there ways that you've wronged God in the same way that you have been wronged? We're called to be a merciful community, and to do this, we need heart transformation. We need to pursue this transformation, I think, before we get hurt, so that we're ready when it happens, and it will definitely happen. This means daily going back to God and what he's done for us through Jesus. The gospel is meant to speak into our day-to-day lives and transform our hearts. When we truly receive and grasp the mercy God has shown to us, that will change our hearts and overflow to others. And that will form and mold us as a whole community. Imagine being part of a community that operates under this system of mercy and not a system of justice. I'll just leave you with a question: what would that look like?